Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. Moving is always exciting and overwhelming, even if it is just across the town or up the street. And this move was no exception. We were moving from Dundee to Geneva, New York, a move of about 30 miles to establish a home in the community where we were planting this church, Living Hope. It had been something we had wanted to do for months, this move, but finding a house we could afford had been proved challenging, especially as we have, had at that time, 6 kids. We have 7 now, and we needed room for everyone. Then one afternoon in August, I spotted a for sale sign at the end of a gravel road. I was riding in a friend's car and I asked him to pull in. He did, and we drove slowly up a long driveway. One side of the driveway was lined with overgrown fruit trees and bushes. The other side bordered a large field with waist-high grass and weeds, all turned a light brown by the hot, dry summer. We dodged the potholes and drove slowly past the field and past a line of maple trees and bushes, and then behind the trees, we arrived at a large, deserted house. My friend parked his SUV in the weeds, and we got out. That house reminded me of buildings my friends and I had explored as children in the San Juan Islands of Washington State. My favorites had been located in a place called Roach Harbor. There, within a large plain of grass, there were 2 or 3 woody areas of scrubby bushes that hid the remains of the original settlers' cabins. If you were willing to push through the brambles and risk the rotting floor, you could climb through a window and wander the 2 or 3 small rooms in each of the deserted houses. Oh, there really wasn't much to see. Any glass that had been in the windows had long ago been broken out, and the few splinters that remained were hard to distinguish from the glass of the broken beer bottles that were scattered all over the floor. I guess these deserted homes were popular hangouts for the partying teens of the islands. Still, I liked exploring these houses. When I was inside, I felt that strange connection with the past you get when you wander through ruins, sort of as if you hear the echo of the voices of the people who once lived there. And I would stand there in the main room and try to imagine what life was like for those early settlers. No electricity, no running water, no indoor toilet. This house in Geneva reminded me of those houses, just a lot bigger. "I'm sure it's all locked up," my friend said. "You'll need to call the realtor." I nodded, but I decided to walk around the house and do that looking into the window thing people do when they're trying to decide whether a house is worth even calling a realtor about. I pushed through that grass, making my way to the rotting small porch that led to the front door. That door looked like it hadn't been opened in a long time. I wasn't sure the boards on the porch would hold me, so I decided to skip it. I walked on around to the other side of the house. Through the weeds, I caught a glimpse of the house's foundation, all rock and mortar. It reminded me of the rock huts I tried to build as a boy. My friends and I would stack rocks and then pack them together with mud, imagining that we were building the walls of future houses. Of course, those never amounted to much, as they'd always seem to topple over when they got higher than a foot or two. I doubt any one of us became an engineer. Anyhow, that's how the foundation looked, and to my untrained eye, it didn't seem a whole lot sturdier. In the back of the house, I discovered an open door, wide open to the field that stretched out from that side. And I hesitated, because that just seemed plain creepy. Did I really even want to consider a house that was little more than an abandoned shack? But my curiosity went out, and I carefully made my way through the open door. As I entered, I saw that my gut instinct had been right. This house had been abandoned for a good long while. There were cobwebs, small piles of dirt here and there, and some leftover trash where some wanderer had passed the night. The air had a cool, musty odor. I flipped a light switch, one of those old-fashioned light switches. Nothing, of course, no power. Made my way through the kitchen. No finished ceiling in there, just hand-hewn beams with old-framed black electrical cords tacked to them. Next to the kitchen, I found a door to an empty garage. The door had been kicked in from the garage side, and now it just sort of hung there limply by one hinge. And I noticed that somebody had spray-painted graffiti onto the garage's wall. I went back into the house and climbed the stairs to the second floor. It was all bedrooms with a long corridor running down the center. Lath and plaster walls, all a little bit beat-looking. My friend came up behind me. "What do you think?" he asked. "Bit of a dump, isn't it?" I answered. I looked out a window at the field in the back. "Still," I said, "it's got a lot of land around it, doesn't it? Let's take a look." And so we went back downstairs, through the kitchen, through the kicked-in door to the garage, then out an open side door that led from the garage into the field. That field was a sea of grass, and it was wonderful. I walked through it slowly, putting my hand out and letting the blades of grass tickle the palm of my hands, like Russell Crowe did with the weed in that movie Gladiator. And then at the far edge of the field, I stopped and I looked back. All I could see was the house, the trees, and the grass. No other houses, no other people, no cars, nothing. Total seclusion. Beautiful. So I called the realtor. Yep, the house had been sitting empty there for more than a year. Yep, it was all built in 1865. And yep, it was in foreclosure. And anyone who bought it would have to buy it as is. Still, the realtor assured me, the foundation was solid. Wow, tough. The price was great, but the house had issues. So we had a tough decision to make. Well, ultimately, we did buy it. What finally tipped us in that direction was the number of bedrooms. There was room for everyone in that house. And it's been a lot of work, and neither I nor my wife Nicole can call ourselves do-it-yourselfers. Carpentry is not something they taught us in music conservatory or Bible school or seminary. But we painted walls and repaired doors and updated some outlets. And then we moved in, doing the whole U-Haul thing with all the bed frames and mattresses, sofas, tables and chairs and books, boxes and boxes and boxes of books. And slowly, gradually, we settled in. With our arrival began my battle with the grass. As much as I enjoyed walking around pretending to be Russell Crowe, we could not permit the house to be swallowed by 5 acres of weeds. And so for the first time, we purchased a riding lawnmower. Now this was exciting stuff. I had never had a riding lawnmower. Most of the mowing I had done was with a non-power lawnmower. I don't even know if they sell them anymore. These things had just, they were blades with wheels that you pushed. You really had to push hard to get them going, and if the grass was tall or wet, it was almost impossible. Where I grew up, in Seattle, the grass was almost always wet. So having a mower that did the work on its own, one that you could ride, that was awesome, an awesome idea. Well, it seemed awesome, until Nicole and I went to the store to look at them. Good grief, they were expensive. No wonder Dad made my brother and me mow with the push mower. But if you're going to mow 5 acres, you don't want to use a push mower, so we bit the bullet and bought one. That immediately led us to another challenge. What were we going to do with the mower when we weren't using it? Not only are they expensive, they're pretty big. We talked, we figured, and then we talked some more. The garage was small, and we needed it for storage. Was there another way? Could we leave it outside? Didn't seem to be the best thing for the mower to leave it outside. Could we build a shed? This latter idea seemed reasonable, but of course, as I said, they don't teach carpentry in seminary. So what to do? Well, oddly enough, if you've got money to spend, you can usually find solutions to such problems. And though we really didn't have the money to spend, we took a look at those solutions. The best option seemed a prefabricated shed, that sort that were being sold at our local do-it-yourself store. So we went out and looked at those. If you start looking at sheds, you'll find there's a wide range of prefabricated options. And if you're willing to spend a lot, you can buy a stick-built structure that looks like a mini house. And for the poorer people like us, well, there are aluminum erector sets. And so we bought our aluminum erector set, a build-it-yourself aluminum shed large enough to house a riding lawnmower, and we brought it home. Big, heavy box that the guys at the store helped load into our van. The whole van settled down under its weight. They didn't teach us how to put together erector sets in seminary or at that do-it-yourself store either, but I figured my training as a 5 or 6-year-old qualified me to screw nuts and bolts together. And so that Saturday, I commenced construction. Someone had laid a small concrete pad behind the house beside some trees, and this seemed a good place to put the shed. So I backed our van up to that spot and dumped that incredibly heavy box of unconstructed shed right there. Then I cut the box open and started laying out the pieces. The big, flat pieces were all sheets of aluminum for the walls and the roof. And then there were these long, narrow bars that would serve as crossbeams and supports. There was also a plastic bag that had a zillion bolts and nuts and a 15-page instruction manual. I don't know about you, but I hate reading instruction manuals. Seriously, how boring can you get? It goes like this, you know, take piece A and place it beside piece D, then take pieces F and G and bolts H and J, see diagram for proper bolt identification, insert F into D bypassing A initially, but then subsequently using nut N to adjoin strut R to A and D. Oh, yuck. Man, gag me. So I don't like reading these things. I can't stand them. And I approach it a little bit differently. What I do is I scan the manual quickly, and then I spend some time studying the pictures. We all know that the pictures are more useful than the words. Then, when I think I've got the idea, off I go. Now that I think about it, this might explain why those erector set projects I did as a little boy never quite looked the way they were supposed to. Maybe explains, too, why I always seem to end up with those leftover parts. Anyhow, back to the shed. Well, I skimmed that manual, and I studied the pictures, and I launched into construction. It took hours, but I must say, it turned out pretty good. It almost looked like the sample one they had set up at the do-it-yourself store. I did learn one important thing doing this, and I'll share it with you here in the off chance it will help you. Don't use a hand screwdriver to screw in all those bolts. Turns out that's like mowing 5 acres with a push mower. Trust me, don't do it. Get an electric drill with a screwdriver attachment and use that. Just a word here to the wise. So there we were with a beautiful new aluminum shed resting on a concrete pad next to the house. You know, I'm a man, hear me roar. I felt so proud I could say that. And that evening I stood with Nicole in the setting sun, gazing proudly at what I had done. Now, as fate would have it, that very night a line of thunderstorms passed through Geneva, bringing strong winds and heavy rains. And in the morning, Nicole and I were awakened by a knock on our bedroom door. Knock, knock. Mom, Dad. It was our daughter, Grace. I groaned and rolled over. The sun was barely up. Yeah, I asked. Your shed, Dad. The wind rolled it around the yard. And it's at the far end of the field. And it's... She paused and I groaned again. It's sort of, well, she said, crumpled. What a terrible way to start a day. Well, sure enough, I got up and looked out the window, and sure enough, like I said, those strong winds had picked up that heavy aluminum shed and thrown it around the yard like a pop can, and it had crumpled the whole deal to boot. It was ruined. All that work, all that money, lost. Later, I pulled out the instruction manual. Sure enough, on page 12 or 13, it had a warning. Be sure to anchor your shed to the ground. If it's on concrete, drill, blah, blah, blah. And then there were a whole lot of other instructions. Using bolt T, attach the bottom of the wall to the concrete using a... But no pictures. Not a single picture warning me that a windstorm might be able to throw that heavy shed around. We come now today to the last section of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. He has spoken at length about the kingdom of heaven, of the righteousness it requires, and he has urged his listeners to prioritize the kingdom and its righteousness above all, turning to its king, Jesus himself, as the legitimate path, both to the righteousness and for entrance into the kingdom. And now he gives an encouragement and a warning in the form of a parable. He speaks of two men, one a wise man, the other a foolish one. Both men decide to build houses. That's appropriate. It is normal and appropriate for men to build places of shelter. Nothing wrong with that. The building of a house in this parable is a metaphor, though, for the building of one's life. You know, each day, the actions we take add to the metaphorical building, which we call our life. When a child is born, he or she is all potential, but nothing actual. There's no history there. She may do good. She may do evil. We do not know which. It's all just future potential. But as a person approaches her dying breath, the potential is almost gone, having been replaced by the actual. What has been done, whether good or evil. If you are hearing this or reading this, the building process for you is ongoing. And to us who are building, Jesus speaks. The difference here, interestingly enough, is not in the quality of the houses these two men construct. For all we know, the actual houses may have been equal in every regard except just this one. And that difference is the foundation. One is built on a rock that cannot be moved, and the other is built on shifting sand. I don't want to pass too quickly by the possibility that these houses might have appeared equal to a casual observer, because so it is in life. Two families can live side by side and appear to enjoy equally happy, productive lives. And this may continue for some time, without it being obvious that the foundational world and life views of the two are radically different. Let's say the one family follows Jesus, and they seek to live a quiet life that glorifies God. And as part of that, they keep a tidy house and a nice yard. They are friendly and hospitable. And the family next to them, let's say, is completely indifferent to any religious belief. They have no interest. They simply believe in being nice. And if they're nice, they think everything's going to work out okay. So they are nice to their neighbors, they are hospitable, and they keep a nice home. Similar on the outside, but very different foundations between these two families. Hey, it happens. Like I've said before, some cult members are the nicest people you'll ever meet. But then Jesus says, storms come. They beat against those houses with vastly different consequences. The one built on the rock remains. The other is destroyed. Jesus himself applies this parable. He says, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, that person is like the man who builds his house on the rock. But the one who hears them and does not do them, he is like the one who builds on sand. Notice that the key difference here is not in the hearing of Jesus' words, but in the doing or the not doing. Now we could look back at those two families I've described, the ones living side by side, and we might be tempted to suggest that these storms Jesus described are the normal hardships of life, things like financial difficulties, illness, or the death of loved ones. And I can understand it might be tempting to suggest that the Christian family would never crumble or suffer shattered lives because of their faith, while the other will inevitably do so. But I think this would be a mistake, and frankly, not always true. I think rather that these storms spoken of here refer to the judgment of God, by God, that we will all face when we die. The scriptures say it is appointed to man once to die, and then the judgment, and so it is. Once our potential has become actual, the house that is our life will pass through a storm of God's holiness and justice. And only those houses that have been built on Jesus, those lives that have been built on Jesus, will stand. One of the beautiful things about God's grace, as I think about this, is that the building of one's life in Jesus can begin at any point. As long as a man has breath, the potential to entrust himself to Jesus and begin building remains. Consider the thief on the cross who that day entrusted himself to Jesus and found himself on that day with Jesus in paradise. But what is required? What is the doing of Jesus' words? Must we work harder, striving to think and do the good we know we ought to do, seeking to earn our own way upward? No, decidedly not. Again, if we have been listening, we have come to know the very thing Jesus said at the beginning of the sermon. Happy or prosperous on the way, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who know, those who own their own spiritual poverty. But if I am indeed impoverished spiritually, how can I become spiritually rich? Well, by accepting the riches extended to me freely as a gift in Jesus Christ. Jesus has spoken repeatedly of entrance into his kingdom. He has made it clear that we require a moral perfection that we, by our own efforts, can never realize. No, we must turn in humble dependence to him. We can enter through him, but only through him. So Jesus says there is a wise man and a foolish one. The foolish one disregards Jesus' teachings. He will rest on his own merits. The wise one heeds Jesus' teachings, and he stakes his all, his future, solely on the merits of the King himself, Jesus Christ. You know, I actually did a pretty good job of building that shed, and I'm going to tell you something funny and a little bit convicting. As I had scanned those instructions at the beginning, I had noticed what it had said about attaching it to concrete, but I ignored them. I ignored those instructions because, frankly, the whole thing just seemed so plain heavy. I was sure no wind could blow it over, so I disregarded the instructions, assuming I knew better. And I was wrong. I underestimated the strength of the wind and the weight of the shed. I should have listened to the people who knew what they were talking about, the people who wrote the instructions. A lot of people are like that. They have built their lives without Jesus. And if you present Jesus to them, they might look around and say, hey, my life's not bad. Why do I need Jesus? Why in the world would I want to start all over with a new foundation? I get it. Moving can be hard and overwhelming. We don't like disruptions. But Jesus is a disruption that everyone needs. The storm of final judgment awaits over the horizon. And the one whose life will remain in that day is the one who has built his life on Jesus. Well, there it is, the Sermon on the Mount. It has ended with a clear challenge. Build your life on Jesus. I hope you will. And if you do, you will be able to join me in saying, the best is yet to come. God bless.